Hey there, constant listeners. Nick Deulius. You found the Far Middle Podcast, and thanks for tuning in. It's the dead of summer, and oddly enough, you start to hear about the start of training camp for a fall and winter sport, football. You got large human beings running around in gear in the summer humidity and 90-degree temperatures. Yikes. So our sports dedication turns to football and how training camp is used to gel a crucial unit of a football team, the offensive line. The O-line's success can't hinge on a single player. It's got to work as a coordinated effort for success. And if the O-line doesn't succeed, the team's not going to succeed either. The offensive line is not glamorous, but it's vitally necessary. And you got to have that ingredient of a good offensive line, because if you don't have that, you're not going to have a successful football team. And its stars are not going to be able to be stars. Now, we've had a few dedications in past episodes to offensive linemen who are some of the NFL greats. And we dedicated a few episodes back to the godfather of offensive line coaching with Coach Joe Moore and his camp that lives on in his memory. But if attributes of successful O-lines in football are analogous to what it takes for teams to win in life or in business, what if we decided to dedicate this episode to the greatest offensive line in NFL history? Who would it be? That's a tough and a fun question to ponder. You could pick the Browns offensive line from the 1950s or the Packers of the 60s, the Steelers of the late 70s, the Hogs in Washington in the 1980s, and then you've got the Cowboys offensive line of the 90s. They were all great, but they weren't the greatest. The greatest offensive line ever designation, that's going to go to the Oakland Raiders of the early 1970s. That had a legendary group of linemen, including four Hall of Famers: Jim Otto, Gene Upshaw, Art Shell, and Bob Boomer Brown, the ultimate offensive line unit. And they were something to behold then. And film today actually does them justice. So check out some vintage photos or films of the Raiders offensive line from the early 1970s. You got their hands that are taped up like giant clubs. They're throwing the opposition all over the mud and the turf. And, you know, honestly and truth be known, they steamrolled the best defenses in football during one of its golden eras. And that includes the Steelers' Steel Curtain from time to time, I have to admit. So the Raiders' offensive line anchored a dynasty that engaged in epic battles with other dynasties during the NFL's golden age. What a special time for pro football. And those four Hall of Famers on the Raiders offensive line, center Jim Otto with his double zeros, guard Gene Upshaw, Bob Boomer Brown at tackle, and also fellow tackle Art Shell, each of them, you could make the argument that each of those were the best ever at their respective positions. And you get some pushback, but you could make the argument objectively. Jim Otto never missed a start in his career. And by the way, we just lost him, unfortunately, earlier this summer. Bob Brown, he was a great run-blocking tackle. Art Shell was an 8-time Pro Bowler. And Gene Upshaw, he went on to be the president of the NFL Players Association. Yeah, for my money, they are the greatest offensive line in NFL history. And this is coming from a Steelers fan who loathed the Raiders as a kid. But the early 1970s Raiders offensive line is very deserving of our episode 164 Far Middle dedication. Now, Bob Boomer Brown was perhaps the most intimidating of the unit. Even Mean Joe Green of the Steelers, perhaps the greatest defensive player in history, admitted that Bob Brown intimidated him. Deacon Jones, another nasty defender, said, quote, "Bob Brown had a cold-blooded mentality. He'd kill a mosquito with an axe." That's Deacon Jones for you. Now, Bob Brown himself said, quote, "I can block anything that was born from a woman," end quote. Boomer Brown played college ball at Nebraska. It's a Cornhusker. And he had his number retired there. And the University of Nebraska is in Lincoln, which makes a connection to our subject for this episode, who called Lincoln, Nebraska home. Now, who might that be? Well, this is both a fascinating and an incredibly impactful individual that we're going to discuss. The most prominent and impactful figures in American political history are typically ones that occupied the White House as president. But there are a few exceptions, quite notable ones. And two that immediately come to mind are Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton. Neither served as president, but of course, both had outsized impacts on the United States, many aspects, by the way, of which still exist today. And there are a couple of other names that fall in that Franklin and Hamilton category, but that are lesser known. Henry Clay and John Calhoun, John C. Calhoun. Neither were president, of course, but exuded tremendous influence and power during their primes. But there's another man, one that had just as much influence and impact on American politics, perhaps arguably even more than Hamilton or Clay or Calhoun. And just about every American outside of political history buffs doesn't know his name. So let's start with his name, William Jennings Bryan. And before we get into his life and the issues that he drove, I want to prep you by stating up front that William Jennings Bryan is going to remind you of more than one prominent current American leader or candidate. And he will also remind you of more than one current major policy or political movement in America today. And that might not be so much a situation of history repeating itself as it is a testament to William Jennings Bryan's legacy on the United States of America. What he drove and what he represented, both the good and the bad, much of it lasts to this day. His legacy is everywhere. And William Jennings Bryan was born in Southern Illinois in 1860, just before the Civil War exploded. He ends up in law school at then Union Law College, which is now Northwestern University. And early in his career, Bryan moved west to Lincoln, the capital of fast-growing Nebraska. Bryan became a successful lawyer and started to campaign for local politicians. And he had the gift of gab, and he was an excellent public speaker. Now, check that. He was an epic public speaker. And you can hear him speak. You can hear some of his speeches on platforms like YouTube if you search for him. Impressive when he was in front of a mic. And a few speeches that people saw when they were able to sort of listen to him, it quickly became evident to those listening about how great he could be as a potential politician. So Bryan ran for Congress in 1890, and he ran on a platform of reducing tariff rates. He supported the coinage of silver at a ratio equal to that of gold, and he wanted to break the power of business trusts. So he was a prototypical populist from rural and small town America. He had an inherent mistrust of big business, and he championed himself as a fighter for the common man. His views at his start were somewhat radical, but, you know, as time went on, his views became mainstream, and many of those views continue to be embedded in American policy today. He won as a Democrat at a time when that party was ascending and obtained a majority in the House of Representatives. So he became a congressman at just the right time, at least with respect to the party that he was affiliated with. Once in the House, Bryan began to morph his views and platform. This was the height of the Gilded Age, remember, and the Democratic Party had begun to separate into two groups. You had sort of the conservative northern bourbon Democrats that sought to limit the size and power of the federal government, but you had another group of Democrats, largely farmers of the South and the West, who favored greater federal intervention to help farmers and to regulate railroads and to limit the power of large corporations. And we discussed that, hit on that, when talking about the farmer movement through the years, back in episode, I believe, 148 this past March. So Bryan became affiliated with the latter group of farmers and populists within the Democratic Party, and he advocated for the free coinage of silver, as I said, what was called the Free Silver Movement, and the establishment of a progressive federal income tax. Now, that endeared him to many reformers, and Bryan was successful in the establishment of the first peacetime federal income tax. Thanks, William Jennings. Thanks a lot. And as the economy declined after the panic of 1893, he became more popular among many voters. And rather than running for re-election in the House in 1894, Bryan sought election to the United States Senate, and he lost. But when losing, or as he lost, he gained more notoriety and popularity, and his national profile was surging. So it was a weird sort of combination of an election loss, but yet his brand was growing. Speaking fees allowed Bryan to give up his legal practice, and he ended up devoting himself full-time to public speaking and politics. His defining moment that took him nationwide tied back to the free silver movement and populism. Bryan called the gold standard, quote, not only un-American, but anti-American, end quote. and he used the issue to emerge as the nation's leading Democrat. He had a very famous speech that became known as the Cross of Gold speech that he gave at the Democratic National Convention in 1896. And in that speech, he argued that the debate over monetary policy was part of a broader struggle for democracy and for political independence and for the welfare of what he referenced again as the common man. Now, I'm going to understate things here by calling Bryan's speech, that Cross of Gold speech, a success. After he gave that speech, he was met with applause on the floor of the convention that lasted over half an hour after he wrapped the speech. And here's the famous ending lines of the Cross of Gold speech, from which it got its name. He said, "If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard is a good thing. We shall fight them to the uttermost, having behind us the producing masses of the nation and the world, having behind us the commercial interests and the laboring interests and all the toiling masses. We shall answer their demands for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." It's a powerful speech. And how about this line from early in the speech? This was towards the beginning of it. "The individual is but an atom. He is born, he acts, he dies, but principles are eternal. And this has been a contest over a principle." He could certainly frame things up. I will give him that. And another great line in the middle of the speech: "This was a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country." Does that sound familiar or similar to rhetoric that you hear today from certain circles? It should. Yeah, that Cross of Gold speech was something else. It secured for Bryan the Democratic nomination for president. And there he was at the age of 36. He became, and still remains, I believe, the youngest presidential nominee of a major party in American history. Did you know that? Now, Bryan faced off against Republican candidate William McKinley in the 1896 election. And McKinley, he campaigned from his front porch, and he had a big funding advantage. Bryan went on the road and gave hundreds of speeches, 20 to 30 a day, many of them taking on an almost religious revival feel. McKinley, of course, won, became president. He won by taking the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Upper Midwest. Bryan took the South and the midsection and western part of the United States, excluding California. And despite the loss, Bryan's support within his coalition, once again, it grew stronger. I mean, the more the guy lost, the more popular he became, it seemed. And he easily won the Democratic nomination and ran again for president in 1900. And once again, he faced McKinley. But this time, McKinley was the incumbent, and he had the charismatic Teddy Roosevelt as vice president. So Bryan decided that this campaign, he would focus more on anti-imperialism, and he would argue against the U.S. assuming control of the Philippines. Bryan argued that the United States should refrain from imperialism and should seek to become what he called supreme moral factor in the world's progress and the accepted arbiter of the world's disputes. Again, you do hear echoes of that today from certain circles, don't you? And the American Anti-Imperialist League, which existed, included Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain. They didn't exactly love Bryan, but his strong stance against imperialism garnered their support. So the 1900 Democratic campaign relied on basically Bryan's ability to do great public speaking. Now get this, in a typical day, he gave 4-hour-long speeches, and then he gave a bunch of shorter talks. When you added it all up, it was 6 hours of speaking at an average rate of 175 words a minute. That means he turned out 63,000 words a day. That's enough to fill 52 columns of a newspaper. And that's going to, I'm assuming, going to wear on a speaker's voice. Yet he moved people with his words. And one observer described it as the poor, the weak, the humble, the aged, the infirm would rush forward by the hundreds holding up hard and wrinkled hands with crooked fingers and cracked knuckles to the young great orator, as if he were in very truth their promised redeemer from bondage. Yeah, he was persuasive. People had to hear him, had to see him. Yet McKinley won again, and by an even wider margin than in 1896. Bryan lost his home state of Nebraska. After the 1900 election loss, he returned to journalism and public speaking, and he began publishing his weekly newspaper. It was called The Commoner, which echoed his views. And by the way, Bryan's nickname was The Great Commoner. And The Commoner newspaper became one of the most widely read of its era and boasted 145,000 subscribers. President McKinley, he ends up being assassinated. Teddy Roosevelt becomes president. And Teddy had moved to the left. He favored federal regulation of railroad rates and meatpacking plants. Of course, he was very big on trust busting. And Roosevelt as president, he adopted policies that looked a lot like what Bryan advocated for when he ran for president. So Bryan saw much of his platform implemented by his opposition. Again, you see echoes of that to this day in current American politics. However, Bryan didn't stand still. He kept moving to more progressive policies. He favored federal regulation of banks and securities, protections for union organizers, federal spending on highway construction and education. Transparency and campaign contributions was a big pillar of his platform. Government control of the currency was another leg of the platform. And all of those things, we have them today on a massive scale, with mediocre success, to be kind. And for a third time, what's Bryan do? He ran as the Democratic nominee for president in 1908 against Taft. Bryan, as candidate, favored requiring national banks to provide deposit insurance. Hello, FDIC. And he unified the labor movement, secured the first ever presidential endorsement by the American Federation of Labor. And today, of course, it's the AFL-CIO, and its endorsement still matters greatly in politics. But because the Republicans also moved to the left, there wasn't much difference between Bryan and Taft in 1908. Taft won easily. He took almost everything outside of the South. So Bryan, he ends up being a three-time presidential election loser. But you know what? The 493 cumulative electoral votes cast for Bryan across those three separate elections, they're the most received by a presidential candidate who was never elected. Bryan became crucial in helping Woodrow Wilson secure the Democratic nomination for president in 1912. Then Wilson, of course, ends up winning the presidency when he beat the split Republicans of Roosevelt and Taft. So when President Wilson takes office, it's time to return the favor. He names Bryan as Secretary of State, which was probably the most prestigious appointive position. And Bryan's extensive travels and his popularity in the party, his support for Wilson in the election, it sort of made him the obvious choice. Wilson said in nominating Bryan as Secretary of State that this is only natural for the man who has led in the transformation of the national attitudes. I think Woodrow Wilson summed up Bryan's legacy quite well there. Now, check this out. I read and came across this preparing for the episode. The State Department at that time, when Bryan became Secretary of State, it had 150 employees in Washington and an additional 400 employees in embassies around the world. That was it. Basically, 550 employees worldwide. Not exactly the case today when it becomes the State Department, is it? Bryan also helped Wilson reduce tariff rates, impose a progressive income tax, yet again introduce new antitrust measures, and establish the Federal Reserve System. Good and bad there, both of which, once again, exist today. But the honeymoon with President Wilson, it wouldn't last because Wilson was a globalist at heart and viewed America as a leader in the world, while Bryan was a staunch isolationist. The falling out occurred over World War I, not surprisingly, and with the European powers. Wilson was very sympathetic to the Allies, so the UK, France, Russia, Italy, while Bryan favored strict neutrality. And when the Lusitania was sunk by a German U-boat and American citizens were killed as passengers, Bryan did not want to take Germany to task, and Wilson clearly didn't see it that way. Before you knew it, Bryan resigned as Secretary of State. After leaving office, he spent a lot of his time advocating for the 8-hour workday, a minimum wage, the right of unions to strike, and women's suffrage. However, his main crusades focused on support for prohibition and opposition to the teaching of evolution in schools. He called for state and local laws banning the public schools from teaching evolution. So that is a mixed bag for sure. And we see the mix play prominent 100 years later. In fact, in the 1920s, Bryan shifted his focus away from politics, becoming one of the most prominent religious figures in the country. And that's when things started to darken for him, because all the religious and evolution posturing, it led to a famous event that that didn't leave Bryan in a good light. In July 1925, Bryan participated in the highly publicized Scopes trial. The defendant, John Scopes, had violated a Tennessee law that barred teaching of evolution in public schools when he was serving as a substitute biology teacher, and his defense was funded by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, when the ACLU used to stick up for free speech, and his defense was led in court by the famed lawyer Clarence Darrow. Darrow argued that the statute violated the First Amendment of the Constitution, the Establishment Clause, and Bryan was defending the right of parents to choose what schools teach, arguing that Darwinism was trying to invalidate what he called every moral standard that the Bible gives us. Now, ultimately, the judge instructed the jury to render a verdict of guilty, and Scopes, he ended up being fined $100 for violating the law. And the national media reported the trial in great detail. Like I said, it was a nationwide event, and many in the media ridiculed Bryan as a symbol of ignorance and anti-intellectualism. Bryan wrote that science is a magnificent material force, but it is not a teacher of morals. Now, Will Rogers once said about Bryan in the Scopes trial, "I like Bill Bryan, but he is making a fool out of himself and out of religion." So the dilution of science and the scientific method and replacing it with ideology or religion, hey, that started long ago, constant listeners. It's not just didn't pop up today with climate alarmism. William Jennings Bryan, yeah, he was far from perfect, at least from the perspective of my philosophy and beliefs. He was for big government, perhaps mainly because of his distrust of big business, whereby he trusted the government agency or the government bureaucrat more than the private sector capitalist. And he could be at times anti-individual rights, whether it was with respect to African Americans in the post-Civil War era or with denying individual choice through the support of prohibition. And ironically, despite him being a great public speaker, he had positions at times that were anti-free speech, primarily his opposition to the teaching of evolution, which meant that at times he could place ideology and religion above science, as evidenced by his role in the Scopes trial. But the man also brought many substantial positives, particularly for the small town and the farmer and the industrial worker and the middle class. He earned his moniker of the Great Commoner. He was a force to be reckoned with, and his fingerprints remain across American policy and society to this day. And he was, if nothing else, a courageous voice for the commoner at a time when the little guy needed such a champion. Few others can lay claim to substantially changing both their party as well as the opposition. Bryan certainly can lay claim to doing both. And I'm fascinated by the guy and wonder what his views would be of America today. So the Federal Reserve, would he view it as a protector of the little guy or an out-of-control beast laying waste to the commoner to enrich the 1%? Would big government still be a good thing from his perspective, or would it now represent to him a bigger threat than big business? And the religion of climate alarmism forcing its way to become the science, subsuming real science, would he see that as a moral imperative that needed tackling climate change, or the suppression of the individual and middle class and science itself? Would Bryan's support of private sector unions, would that translate to support of public unions and their political monopoly power today? Or would he view public sector unions as a very different and dangerous thing, much like FDR did after him? Hey, speaking of FDR, the reality is there would be no FDR, there would be no New Deal if there was no William Jennings Bryan. So you talk about alternative history scenarios, there's one staring us right in the face when it comes to the New Deal and what FDR was able to accomplish. I sense Bryan was obviously onto something with his policies and how they took root in American politics and society. Yet I also sense they got completely out of control after Brian's time, to the point where the Frankenstein monster is now running wild. No matter how you cut it, though, William Jennings Bryan was a great American, perhaps one of the greatest, and more Americans, they need to know his story. Let's end this episode by making a connection from William Jennings Bryan to his impact on culture, maybe pop culture even, in America. Because it's widely rumored that the author of The Wizard of Oz, Frank Baum, based the character of the Cowardly Lion on William Jennings Bryan. I suppose Baum was not a fan of Bryan. And that would have been early in William Jennings Bryan's career because The Wizard of Oz was published as a book in 1900. So speaking of The Wizard of Oz, let's pivot to the epic 1939 film version of the story. It is the most watched film of all time, according to the Library of Congress. That film had a lot of strange and bizarre happenings tied to it, and I find them fascinating, so let's discuss a few of the more interesting ones. The female terrier, who played Toto, was paid $125 a week, while the Munchkins earned $50 a week, and the Munchkins' manager took half of the $50. Toto's real name, by the way, was Terry, and she was injured during filming after a crew member accidentally stepped on her, but people actors making a fraction of dogs, calling William Jennings Bryan. And if you thought that was bad from a pay equity perspective, how about this? Judy Garland earned $500 a week, while Ray Bolger, the Scarecrow, and Jack Haley, the Tin Man, they earned $3,000 a week. That's six times as much. Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West, she was literally physically tortured on set. Her costume caught on fire while filming, and she was severely burned on her face and hand, which caused her to take medical leave for 6 weeks. And not only did the green face paint that she wore get stuck on her face for weeks after filming, but the chemicals were so toxic that she was unable to eat whole foods and was forced to go on a liquid diet. Now, where was OSHA when you needed it? Ray Bolger, again, who played the Scarecrow, he wore face prosthetics that ended up leaving marks on his face for more than a year. And get this one. This is an odd one. Buddy Ebsen. Now, he's best known for playing the lead role Jed on the Beverly Hillbillies. And he was also the lead on the 1970s detective show Barnaby Jones. Buddy Ebsen was cast as the original Tin Man. But when Ebsen was in the role, the aluminum dust that was used in the initial costume, he had a terrible reaction to it, which led to his lungs collapsing, and he had to be hospitalized for weeks. So he was replaced by Jack Haley, and the makeup was replaced with a safer aluminum paste. But still, Jack Haley eventually caught a severe eye infection due to the makeup. And how about this one? Judy Garland's daughter, of course, Liza Minnelli, she was married to Jack Haley's son, Jack Haley Jr., in the mid-late 1970s. So Dorothy's daughter married the Tin Man's son. How about that? Hey, enjoy the week and stay connected to that far middle.